So while we are practicing kind of sculpturally and painterly ways to kind of conceptualize the projects, the approach to creating them and the technology used is custom. You know, in the same way that Jackson Pollock painted on glass or horizontally, or Picasso drew with light. I mean, I could go on and on and on, but you know, this idea of creating your own brush, creating your own tool, I think is central to the great architecture studios in the world. And we aspire to build our own tools. And I think that nerding out is necessary, I think, in any field to innovate. You can speak culturally and cultural terms and political terms all day long and theoretical terms, but if you're not innovating technologically, I don't see how you can be relevant.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to Designed, an architecture podcast. We appreciate you listening, and once you're finished, please take a moment to subscribe to the podcast, rate us, and leave a comment. Enjoy the show, and have a wonderful day.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Designed with me, your host, Aaron Prinz. As always, I just want to start the podcast by reaching out to all of you and saying thank you to all of you for listening to the podcast, sharing it with your friends, rating it on the iTunes review section. That's really the easiest way for us to spread the podcast to more people is just by leaving a rating on the iTunes section and maybe a comment. Let us know what you think. And it's just a simple thing to really show your support. Be sure to check out our website, designpodcast.com. There you can find everything Designed. You can see all of our episodes, stream the episodes right from the website. Also has links to all of our social media pages, like our Instagram page at designed.podcast. We got some really nice student work there and helps you keep up to date with everything going on. This week's episode, we have Alex Josephson. He's a founding member of Partisans. They're a Toronto-based architecture firm. And they're recently named the Royal Architecture Institute of Canada's Emerging Architecture Practice Award. This episode was kind of crazy, caught me off guard. He's a really cool guy, and his whole experience of going through architecture school and kind of taking chances and looking at things differently, I think is something that we hear a lot, but I think he's really put it into practice in how they've developed their firm and really the work they're doing and their approach to architecture, I think is... it's just so genuine to his personality, and I hope you see that through this interview. It was a really fun conversation. He's a really great guy to talk to. So sit back, relax, enjoy. Here we go with Alex Josephson. I was on your website, and I think one quote from your website that really struck me. You have this big headline, and it says, "Beauty emerges when design misbehaves." I was wondering, just to start, can you kind of elaborate on kind of what this means to you? And with the Partisans' design strategy and the design process, how does that fit into the work that you're producing?
Beauty emerges when design misbehaves. So the idea behind that, there's a lot behind it. But, you know, we don't mean misbehavior like kids misbehaving and throwing a temper tantrum. You know, really what it, I think, comes from is this idea of our studio as a project unto itself, and that what we bring to our projects is the ability to ask why, or even say no. That act of questioning, I think, is a misbehavior, because in a service-driven industry, you're kind of supposed to just, you're kind of given briefs, especially, you know, when you enter competitions. You know, more and more RFPs and briefs are prescriptive, and you know, we're more interested in a kind of freedom, a design freedom, and the ability to discover unexpected solutions along the way. And I think that that kind of unexpected moment is that misbehavior. I always loved that line that Frank Gehry says, you know, if you knew what you were going to design before you designed it, then what would be the point in designing it? So there's this idea that I think today, you know, design has never been more consumed. It's never been more mainstream. Architecture is getting there, but you know, this idea of, you know, fighting for a cause, fighting for an idea, fighting for the party, fighting for a concept is what I mean by misbehavior, and cherishing it like a child, you know.
Well, there's also, I think there's a thing with you have to have a special type of client that would kind of foster this sort of creativity, and I don't know, those clients seem to be, well, my perception would be that those type of clients are not few and far between, but they're harder to come by. Like, if you want to find somebody to do, you know, just a classic apartment building, wood siding, all that, you can probably find 100 of those, but that's not the work you guys are doing. So you mentioned competitions and everything, but how are you going about finding these clients that allow you to do this work?
That's like the magic. That's like the jelly. Yeah. How do you do your job? You do what you, you know, like,
to be honest, if you could just list out their phone numbers, that would be helpful.
Yeah. I would love to share. I'm very much like a sharing person. You know, first, I don't want to get ahead of myself. I think we're just getting started. I think we're behind, to be honest with you. Like, I think we live in a country that's quite slow. Canada is very contemplative, you know, ponderous and process driven. And what kind of clients do we have? I think that we constantly through this
word. I mean,
it's, it's a great question. I can answer it. I can answer it well. this is the deal. So you asked a question about beauty emerges when design misbehaves. So do clients. I believe truly that clients out there are just as hungry for innovation, for the journey, for the experience. The ultimate experience in life would be to shape the space around you. I mean, it's the most cost and time intensive thing you could do as an individual, building and defining the space around you, right? It's a privilege. It's a true privilege. And so that's why architecture is, like, in my opinion, this privileged arena for people to practice in. So when I say, so do clients emerge from misbehavior? I'll give you an example. We wrote a book called Rise and Sprawl. Rise and Sprawl was a sort of like what you might call satirical takedown of the entire condominiumization of Canada, but Toronto in specific. And basically with Hans Ebelings wrote this book. And I mean, it was like putting fire in a room with all the developers in Toronto. You know, like, nobody wanted to talk to us because, you know, you put enough crap in a room or crap in a space, it all starts to smell, right? So what that did was it basically polarized our studio. Someone had to say it, though. There's a real lack of critical apparatus in architecture right now. It's a lot about digital and design consumption rather than critical interface. And architects crave criticism. I truly don't believe it's just about ego. I think architects are people who truly want to be part of a critical dialogue. So what that book did, for example, was bring the two developers in this entire giant city of 7 million people that may have the same kind of ethos we do to the fore, right? And so that act where, you know, we put this object out into the world that put our position clear with respect to the way architecture was being built here actually brought us work. And those kinds of people are special people, right? They're the people who were like charged up, you know, like that book made them think, you know what, those people are thinking, I want to work with them. Even though they may not have built a building yet, they really understand what this is about. And I want to do something different. And by the way, I can also make money because they're thinking differently. And I can create a different product, you know, because they think in product, right? Developers think in product and marketing, right? You know, like city building is still a kind of marketing. I don't want to be cynical about it, but fundamentally, you know, when you're talking about nine figures, you know, there's some financial realities to these things. And no matter how altruistic you think you're being, you know, you're part of a system, right? And I think acknowledging that and being critical within it brings out the special characters even within those systems. And then, you know, the other stuff that we do, you know, when I said we treat Partisans as a project itself, you know, we're doing stuff all the time that has no client. And I think those projects bring clients. So for example, my thesis in 2010 was a temporary mosque. And that brought two of our first clients. And it was something that I used scholarship money to build. Like, I used my scholarship money to build an installation and finish my thesis. And that actually, like, I was at an art show in Toronto and I met a man. And he liked the banter and he saw my thesis in the newspaper and he hired us because of it. And so, you know, when I teach at U of T, for instance, I say, you know, this isn't a dress rehearsal. This is the real thing. The work you're doing right now to my students, I say, this could bring you work. I don't know where life is taking us, but, you know, it really started with this installation. And it proves that, you know, you get work by doing your own work and thinking for yourself.
I think it's interesting that a lot of, I will say, young architects, especially in school, where that the whole business aspect of architecture isn't even something that's really taught in school. I feel like everything is like design, 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 and it's just magically you're going to have a business somehow. But I think what you're speaking to, especially
It's just magical. Yeah.
It just happens, right?
Like, you know, I'm going to twitch my nose. It's.
But I think there is like a huge business aspect to architecture of landing clients and this sort of thing. So If you were to think back and go through it, like what business aspects do you wish you kind of would have known going into this whole endeavor that you've learned along the way?
Oh man, you know, it's a good question. The most important aspect of that little issue about business and architecture is if you learn business before you practice architecture, can you be a good architect? Can you be a creative architect? I think there is an internal snobbery within architecture with respect to international style firms that, you know, capture talent out of schools and kind of, you know, it's a pastiche of styles and, you know, sort of like simulacra of, you know, critical theorists or critical practices that, you know, are doing the most important work in the world, and then they riff on it, right? I still think there's innovation at those scales. But, you know, I think we have to ask what success is. You know, I have no desire to run a 2,000 or 10,000 person firm. I have no desire for Artisans to become a 10,000 person firm. I think that at that scale, it becomes about keeping the machine going to a certain extent. There's nothing, I think, wrong with that. But when the machine and the cost of the machine is so high, and the process of getting work, you know, can stifle future generations, I have a problem with that. You know, I think that architecture is fundamentally too important to stifle, you know, next generation thinking. And so I think it's the responsibility of architects to think about the next generation. And it's not that I don't think firms do. I mean, they hire new students all the time. But the question is, you know, what's more important, the machine or architecture? You know, and you have to ask yourself those questions. Do I think that being a star architect that employs slave labor is any better? No, right? So you like, it's two sides to this like coin of success in architecture. You know, are you a giant corporate shill, or are you a star architect that basically takes advantage of the incredible desire to share your air, you know, in the same room and sacrifice also, for you?
There's a myth, I think, that like the star architect is not a big corporate firm. You know what I mean? I with the budgets, those, there's some sort of corporate hierarchy. You know what I mean? Like they are just,
I think it's got, I think they've gotten much more organized, but there's certainly like a fast and loose, there's a difference. You know, I would say like I've worked in a couple of those studios and usury is, you know, I mean, maybe not usury, but I've worked in those studios and they take advantage of, you know, the opposite coin of corporatism, where it's like, you know, they really shuffle through people. The churn is incredible. I think that's what differentiates a corporate studio from a Starkitect, the churn of staff at Starkitecture studios. And it's not, I don't know if that's been written about a lot, but you know, you're talking about people there that are, you know, coming in and out every 2 months. Like it's shit through a goose, as we say in Canada.
We had Alvin Wong on here and he worked for Zaha. And yeah. He said he worked there for 3 years and he added up his timesheets when he was done. And it came out to 7.5 years work of full-time employment he did in 3 years because he was just there all the time. I'm like,
he probably had an extraordinary 3 years, like 80 hours a week, to be honest with you. If he was working there for 3 years and he did 80-hour weeks, like if you're really in love with architecture, it's not really a job, right? You know, and you're also kind of like, it's really a different thing. Like I just, everybody's like, you talk about career and it's like, you know, like maybe that's the difference between, you know, like, no, I don't want to create differences. Like, I just think that, you know, for me, it's not it's much more kind of passionate than the word job.
Before we dive too far into your career here, because we have a lot to talk about, real quickly, can you just take our audience through where you grew up? And what your parents did, the economics of the household, and out of all the things you could have done in life, why the heck architecture?
Yeah, I mean, I was on the phone yesterday with a one of the board members of the hospital here, Women's College Hospital in Toronto, and she told me about her, you know, she asked me this question, and I answered it, and then she told me her story, and I was like, God, I am like Mr. Privilege, you know, like I come from Toronto, it's a city in Canada. You know, it's this country on the north side of North America that is sort of like an island in this abyss of global turmoil. You know, first, like being born in Canada, I think is extraordinarily fortunate. I think it's a special place. Grew up, you know, in a Jewish family in Toronto. Really fortunate, just really, really fortunate and lucky. I would say that architecture came to me really because of a funny thing. When I was 7 years old, I had a crush on a girl. Her name was Jessica Slan. And I was so in love with Jessica that I started drawing her a castle, like this crazy castle, and that I would build for her one day. You know, I was going to, you know, build this castle for her. And I drew elevations of it, sections of it. I don't even know how I learned how to, these things should have even section drawings. And I gave them to her. I think her mother or father told my parents, you know, your son drew a castle for our daughter. You should see this thing. And then my parents found out about this castle and I was very embarrassed and because I had drawn it for Jessica. And they were like, well, do you know what that, you know, who, what you are if you draw buildings? And I said, I don't know. You're an architect. And I was like, I don't think I could pronounce the word. It was too many syllables, just like my last name, you know, like Josephson, architecture, you know, like too many syllables. So they told me it was called an architect. What I didn't understand was, one, how potentially scared they were that I would want to do that. And two, that it would actually be my format for rebellion in the kind of conservative Canadian background that I grew up in. Pursuing architecture the way I've pursued it is like anathema.
Well, you first went to school, you also studied sculpture, right? So you have this sort of dual degree, architecture, sculpture. Those two things.
Well, I don't have a dual degree in it. I don't want to be misleading, but I was always doing and taking classes in sculpture on the side outside of university, as well as taking art history and art in university. I was really lucky again, like, you know, it's sort of like, you know, if we make anything out of this thing called Partisans, it'll be a miracle because the story of us is, you know, sort of privileged and boring. You know, my partners are more interesting. They come from war-torn countries like Iran and South Africa. And so, you know, they're more like, you know, they're true dissidents in their own way. And they've been through more, I would say, more fascinating contexts of development. And so it's not just me. Partisans is Puya Bakdash and John Friedman and me. And so I'm kind of like this milquetoast Jewish kid from Toronto that didn't realize it until he was about 22. But the reason he didn't, you know, get involved with drinking and drugs, you know, was because architecture was the drug. You know, it was truly the rebellion. You know, like nobody in my circle was going into art or architecture. You know, that was like my parents were super supportive. That's something we have to say. They were supportive, but also incredibly critical. So support was a very kind of interesting word. But like, there was a moment where my father was like, you've chosen to become an actor to me. Like, you have chosen to become an actor, as if being an actor was ignoble or something. You know, but that's the kind of background you come from. And, you know, I love my parents, my father especially. They've given me opportunities like no other, not like no other, but like, you know, listen, there's far more privileged people than me. Let me put it to you like that. It's like, you know, upper middle class. I'm not like, you know, we're not talking about some of the other characters in architecture, but that's what my background is. Right. So architecture was my format for rebelling. And my high school teacher was a true classical artist who eventually killed himself. And that was a huge trauma to me. But he taught me classical drawing. He taught me sculpture. And he taught me classical painting and color theory. And this was all in high school. And this man was a sort of renowned portrait artist, a very troubled man named John Villion. And, you know, this was one of the most talented people in the country. But Canada has a hard time celebrating people, and especially, you know, in architecture, design, and art. It's a tough slog. It's only now that, you know, really developing this acumen and sort of appreciation and ability to celebrate these fields because, you know, this is a country that's prided itself on, you know, cutting trees down, sucking oil out of the ground, and bringing up the gold. You know, like, it's not a country that's built on a kind of, like, sort of innovation, intellectual, what you might call structure. It's about resources, the land, humanism, right? And those things are extraordinary. They're incredible. And I think they make us who we are as creatives in Canada, or what do you want to call us, architects, designers. But my background, yeah, is sort of in the arts. And then, you know, I kind of, you know, went to architecture school.
Well, how has that kind of art and sculpture background when it comes to design and form and all of that, how have those two things kind of influenced one another?
I had a kind of second childhood or a second adolescence. I was working for a corporate firm in Toronto called Diamond & Schmidt, and I really didn't fit in. Like, I literally was just like, it didn't work. And I got in a lot of trouble. You know, I said what I wanted, I did what I wanted, and kind of, you know, didn't fit in. But this guy, Michele Guicciardi, came up to me. He's like, Alex, you don't belong here. You know, and there's this beautiful Italian accent, this beautiful tie, you know. And he comes up to my computer and he goes, look, you have to go here. You have to be in Italia. You know, and he types in www.fuxus.it. You know, Fuxus is architecture firm in Rome. And I saw this website and I was just like, holy shit, that's where I got to be. And so I did everything in my human capacity to try and get a job at this place. And I actually mailed, at the time I was building my portfolios out of old Playboy magazines. I would take a Playboy magazine and I would paste my work in it. It looked like the portfolio was borderline pornographic. I saw how portfolios were looked at, and I thought, you know, architecture's become all about this kind of image porn. And so I created a portfolio that was essentially based on image porn. I made one with a wallpaper magazine. I made one with a Playboy. Like, every year was a different magazine that I would make my portfolio out of. And I sent these to Italy and I sent the digital version, and somehow I got a job there. I didn't speak a word of Italian. I asked my parents, I was like, listen, I'm going to ask you something crazy. Can I go to Italy for a couple of years? And they were like, what? You know, and I literally went there without anything. Like, I just went. And I was very lucky because Waterloo had a studio there and they put me up in the pre-Jerome studio. But I ended up staying in Italy for 5 years. I had a studio there. I finished my bachelor's there. I did my entire master's there in a degree that was supported by Waterloo and the University of Rome. So I took a few courses at the University of Rome. I basically absconded to Italy. You know, I worked for Fuxus and I fell in love with an Italian girl. Between her and the studio and Rome and the other people I met there and starting to do art, you know, for a while I abandoned architecture and I was looking at art, and that's how the Temporary Mosque came about, but our first project. But like, basically Italy was my second, I would say second adolescence, because it opened my eyes. Had to start from scratch there, you know, like going from Canada to Italy. It was incredible. You know, I became a snob. Like, it was brutal. Like, I had to really come back from it because the swing was so hard. I just, you know, everything was just better outside of Canada. You know, basically Italy finished in around 2009. There was the financial crisis. The whole world was collapsing. You know, I've zoomed forward 10 years, right? From starting in 2001, 2002, right? The world was just coming to an end, it seemed, with this financial crisis. But I won this fellowship in New York at the Van Allen Institute. And that was my kind of parachute out of Italy. That's when stuff started to get really interesting. In 2010, I finished my thesis. I did the Temporary Mosque installation a year before. And, you know, I got in a bit of trouble in New York because I projected a design constitution, an architecture constitution on the side of the UN building. It was just like the Van Allen Institute thought I was a criminal. The UN security thought I was a criminal. I didn't get deported, but, you know, I have pictures of this. You'll see the UN building, and I have a great photograph. It was pouring rain, and I'd spent all my grant money from Van Allen on this $5,000 projector that could project like a mile. And it said, freedom from fear, freedom from desire, freedom to design, on the side of the UN building. And that was my, you know, trip back to Canada. And I realized at the end of the Van Allen Institute, I wasn't going to have much luck in New York. I was like, well, it's 2009. Where do I go? Where's the money? Where are the cranes? Where are they building? And like, a light bulb went off and it was like, I got to go back home. So that's how.
I want to get into the starting of, or the founding of Partisans. You were at the AA for a semester or a year, a short time. And then I brought up Alvin earlier, but I asked him, I was like, hey, how'd you get your job at Zaha? And he was like, oh, I went to the AA.
I don't have those pedigrees, man. I'm like a architecture mutt. I got my lowly degrees from Waterloo, you know, and I don't fit in.
Well, the AA, I was there. Well, my school, we did a studio in London, and we walked through the AA, and it's like the least ideal architecture space you can really imagine. I feel like, you know what I mean? It feels like it's just in like an old house, and the corridors are all super narrow and the stair. It was just kind of like, compared to what we have here in the US, it just seemed like a less than ideal building, I guess. But that's
I think that less than ideal spaces are an environment in which struggle occurs, right? I think I'm very, very critical of the temples we're building for architecture. Like I've been openly critical of what we did in Toronto. I think, you know, like the Daniel School of Architecture is just another architecture temple. Why are we not just working in huge, open, trashable warehouses? Like, I just don't get this, you know, like we're building these architecture temples. And I think it's a reaction to the cities around us, where it's like the architecture school has to be emblematic of the most radical architecture. I think that's what's happened with these buildings. But you asked about the AA. Let me tell you the story. So I came back to Canada. I came back to Canada. They made me do these technical courses. You know, like, you want to be an architect, you want your degree, you have to do these technical courses. I was like old by that point. I don't know. I was like 27, 28, you know, and lo and behold, there's this Persian guy that, you know, everybody called Panzer in these classes with me. And you know, all everybody else in these classes was like 25. And we were like the two old dudes in the class, right? Because he was from Iran doing technical courses and I was coming back from Italy doing technical courses. And it was like love at first sight. The Jew and the Muslim, you know, the Jew and the Iranian. Anyway, we're both basically atheists. You know, we don't practice religion, but you know, it was like a perfect storm. And he's fun. He's gregarious. He's got such personality. He's so innovative. And he was doing a thesis on Los Angeles. I skipped many, many steps in the story I told you about my travels, but you know, I ended up living and working in Los Angeles twice, doing some courses there. So he couldn't go to the US because he had these visa issues. So he was doing his thesis on Los Angeles. And I was like, oh, I know all about Los Angeles. And you know, this professor put us together because he knew I'd been in Los Angeles and I could give him help on Los Angeles. And I was doing a thesis on, you know, the Abrahamic religions and, you know, grappling with my like outsider Jew psychological issues and, you know, trying to understand what that meant in post September 11th education and trying to bring the Abrahamic religions together with some kind of universal architecture and engagement. So he was the Muslim that could help me with my thesis on Mecca, because my city was Mecca. It wasn't just the mosque, it was redesigning Mecca. And so that's how we started. And we saw through school together. And then, we went on to work jobs after school in 2010. I worked at a college in Toronto. He worked at an architecture firm in Toronto. But basically, it became clear that I was going to be able to get some work through my relationships and connections in Toronto. And so I was going to get a couple of projects. And I was like, Puya, do you want to start a studio together? And he was like, yeah. Basically, what happened was work was crappy. It was 2012 and or 11. Like, the work we were doing at other studios sucked. We felt very disenfranchised. We felt like we didn't have the pedigree. So I applied to the AA because I was like, you know what? I got to get this pedigree thing done. Got in. I got into Columbia as well, like all these other schools. I chose to go to the AA. And literally, I was like, I can't go without Puya. So I convinced the AA they should also let Puya in. So I told him, so I got him to apply. So it was like we were married and we were going to go to the AA together. And then he was like, you can go. We'll start the studio. I'll stay here. You do the thing there and we'll do it. And I literally, like a month into it, I was like, no, stick a fork. I mean, in Italian, they say, tu sei cotto. You know, I was cooked. You know, like I was cooked. Like there was no more school energy in me. I had to leave. And so I dropped out. Well, and I came back home to Puya.
Those first projects, I mean, those early years, was there a time when maybe, you know, that phone wasn't ringing? And how did you kind of get through those times to kind of get to where you are now?
Let me tell you something, man. The phone never rings. Like this idea that we're sitting around and like the whole world's calling us, just not true. And if the whole world's watching, start calling me. it's like to get great clients, it's a freaking job, man. Some of it's organic, you know, like they'll see your work in the media, but we on every occasion, our best projects have been through deep, deep search relationships, interface dialogue, putting ourselves out there. it's work, and it's enjoyable. It's the thing I enjoy probably after design the most, is the kind of building the studio and finding work for us. And you know, Puya enjoys it too. But we're not in a position yet. I say yet, where you know we're just, the phones are ringing off the hook. And you know, like when I say phones, I mean like, you know, we do get emails and inquiries all the time, but you know, the processes that we like to work through, you know, just the context in which we want to practice are pretty clear, and it scares a lot of people away. It's, you know, I'm not like so fast. It takes time, and things need to gestate. It's challenging when you work in a country. I think we're well known in Canada. I don't know how well known we are outside of Canada, but you know, we're trying to get a larger series of projects going, and you know, getting those is the next step. Getting those is the next step, because in Canada, you have to have done it before you do it. I know that sounds like paradox, but that's how Canada works. Oh, you haven't done that yet? Well, you can't do it then. Building a credibility where we can show our capacity to do better than our incumbent competition is the big struggle here.
Well, talking about putting your work out there and all of that, I think, you know, with parametric design becoming so commonplace within architecture, and then I've brought this up in the last like 3 or 4 podcasts, I should probably stop talking about it, but I get really annoyed, yeah. I guess, is why I'm so infatuated with this, is that you can scroll through these Instagram pages of architecture, and it's just, every image looks like it could be done by the same exact person. I'm tired of seeing pink people in renderings, and you know, just over processed drawings, with all of this online where you can literally build a brand without even having a building built. How do you go about setting yourself apart and making sure that it's not just another scroll on the internet?
So we're called partisans, right? And I think that implies a kind of struggle or a fight. And so when I say beauty emerges when design misbehaves, and our name's Partisans instead of PB&J, Puya Backdash Alex Josephson, that means that you have to question the tools and make your own tools. And I think that's where the art and sculpture thing comes back. We build our own tools. So I think the reason you're seeing homogeneity is the same reason there's been always a homogeneity. When technology is adopted blindly and it isn't tailored and used in unique ways that are true to a series of different, I would say, contexts. In our context, it's very specific. There's this idea of struggle. You know, that creates the kind of familiarity you're talking about that you see across all the work aesthetically and formally, right? Is that a good explanation for you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think that what defines the great studios in the world is hacking those technologies and tools for your own purposes and asking the question why, and applying those things. So I call it, you know, hi-fi, lo-fi. You know, we really crave the hand-hewn, hand-crafted, but you know, there's culture and economic conditions that make that difficult to achieve because of cost. And then there's the technology which allows us to create, you know, uncannily beautiful objects or forms or patterns, whatever you want to call it. You know, if you just apply the technology blindly, I think that the work will be homogeneous. However, if you try and filter it through craft and matter in different ways, you get unexpected results. And I think that that's true of certain projects, like, for instance, the terracotta work that we're doing with masonry right now. You know, technically parametric, right? But when you combine that with a old world material and start to experience the possibilities of that material that the parametric exploration could never have brought you to, then I think you stumble into something new, a discovery, right? And so we're discovering using these tools with these materials versus just, you know, the simulation of using the technology to be part of a movement, right?
I think that's actually a really interesting way of putting it, because I think with the understanding of what these tools are doing, I think is actually the power behind the tools. But I think what we're seeing a lot with what I mentioned earlier is that people see some of the firms we've mentioned earlier, and they're just doing bastardizations of that type of work. Do you know what I mean? Like there's no original yeah. voice. That
oh, I'm very scared things. That we're bastardizing as well. I'm very like, you know, I'm really so, worried. Though. I'm really, well, thank you. My point is, I think you have to, and one of the things we've done at our studio is we've created images that we didn't know how to make and then figured out how to make them. And I think that when you have to figure out how to make something and you have to create the technology to make it, you by definition are discovering formal and aesthetic behaviors and conditions that didn't exist before necessarily, or are extended and improved in a unique way. And so I think, you know, the big problem with architecture is if you don't know how to make it before you draw it, you can't do it. And that's what I think separates corporate architecture, you know, with a capital C, from experimental, innovative, forward-looking architecture practices, because there's a lot of risk inherent in proposing things that you don't know how to build. But having the confidence to say, no, there are human beings out there that can help me do this, and there are programmers out there that will help me fix this issue. And that started all the way in day one at the Grotto in 2013, like really the beginning of our studio. How technology would be hacked and how we would bring in the hackers to the process to make the technology work for us and fix the problems we had and the roadblocks we had is now central to our studio. And so while we are practicing kind of sculpturally and painterly ways to kind of conceptualize the projects, the approach to creating them and the technology used is custom. You know, in the same way that Jackson Pollock painted on glass or horizontally, or Picasso drew with light. I mean, I could go on and on and on, but you know, this idea of creating your own brush, creating your own tool, I think is central to the great architecture studios in the world. And we aspire to build our own tools. And I think that nerding out is necessary, I think, in any field to innovate. You know, you can speak culturally and cultural terms and political terms all day long and theoretical terms, but if you're not innovating technologically, I don't see how you can be relevant.
Well, along those lines, I guess, you know, I've kind of expressed what irritates me about the architecture profession now, but where do you see the profession going? And then also, is there something that, you know, the profession you think has just had enough of and needs to move on from?
I don't think, to be honest with you, it's all good. You know, I think some of the neo postmodernist stuff out there is really kind of cool, actually. You know, I think that there's best examples of that. I think that, you know, the what you call generative design is, you know, it's bifurcated into all sorts of different trajectories. I think that there's interesting aspects to that. I think that those are totally valid ways of practicing architecture, and I'm very open-minded to those things. They don't really, I'm not sure they irritate me as much as they irritate you. It's all part of a healthy struggle, right? You know, one of my favorite designers, Adam Nathaniel Furman, I think his work is really provocative, and I like provocation. Is it the kind of work I do? No, it's not. But it's, you know, it's great work. And I don't know Adam personally except on Instagram, but you know, we talk once in a while. And I think that what I would categorize as like the neo postmodern approach is really fascinating. You know, architecture is questioning itself, and that's what I think that movement's about. And then the generative design direction, the tools, high-tech driven direction, it seems a bit heartless to me. It seems capitalistically driven, even though it's couched in kind of like biophilic or biomathematical terms. I think there's a deep capitalistic aspect to it. What I'm excited about is this idea of like a formal activism where architecture can be critical and engage aesthetically striking but deviant levels. And when I say that, like, I think there are new forms, new curvatures, new geometries that can engage a kind of critical aspect of architecture, especially as it relates to context, in really interesting ways. So I'm excited about that. And I think that's what our studio is really about. I think it's about how narrative, context, and this idea of resistance, you know, produces an expected result. And that those results are able to create different strands and languages within our studio. And do I want our work to all look the same? No, but I want it to all have the perfume.
Well, Partisans also won the 2020 Royal Architecture Institute of Canada's Emerging Architecture Practice Award.
Yeah.
As a firm, for you, kind of what does that mean to you guys? And also, like, if you were to put your, like, in the eyes of the jury, what do you think it was about your firm that made Artisan stand out?
Yeah, so again, I think I'll answer the thing about the RAIC second. We find opportunities where everybody else doesn't at face value see it. That's how we've gotten our work. That's how we've been able to do work. Because all the fancy nice projects go to incumbent studios. You know, we're really, like, what we're focused on is there is the possibility of great architecture in the most unglamorous contexts. I'll give you an example. Innisfil, the Orbit, the city of 250,000 people that we've designed. We won that project. Many firms wrote Innisfil off as not being an interesting place to, you know, that nothing interesting would come out of it. One of the most engaging, provocative, responsible designs for the future of garden city theory was possible there. And we saw that from the beginning. And so I think that this idea of not being a snob when it comes to who your client can be and whether they can create greatness with you is critical to how we work. Not allowing people to make assumptions about the quality of the project they're able to achieve together. So the RAIC, I really think is, listen, awards are kind of like awards and they're nice, but fundamentally, the RAIC award is a big deal for us. And I think a big deal for Canada, because when we started Partisans, you know, we were dissidents. Like, we would get cease and desist letters because we weren't licensed yet. So that nod from a very conservative organization, institution, vaunted, you know, RAIC, I think is a nod to the capacity for architecture to do more than achieve briefs, build, you know, create permits and beautiful architecture. Like, it says that architecture is more. It's about activism. It's about politics. It's about a whole bunch of other things than just achieving buildings. And I think that that's what the award means to us and what it implies in the context of that vaunted and respected organization, our National Institute of Architecture, and what potentially differentiates the importance of this year's award from others.
What's your proudest moment in architecture?
Oh, man. Oh, maybe I haven't had it yet. You know what? You know what the proudest moment actually maybe is? When you visit we haven't finished a lot of projects. We've finished a few. I think it's like when there are moments in a project where you did so much better than any rendering you did. And you were so true to the idea and concept and rendering that it went beyond. And then when you experience that in physical format, it's pretty freaking moving, because your clients who you did this with, it brings you to kind of like tears, because you've made a group of people so happy and proud themselves. It's a kind of weird moment. Like, I guess it's the architectural equivalent of being on a stage and people clapping or something like this. But like, when you really did something well and it's better than you rendered it or drew it, and people are happy and it made their lives better. Like, that's a really, you can't really describe that feeling.
What's the biggest setback you've had in your career, and how have you used it to get to where you are today?
Whoa, we've had a lot of setbacks. I feel like architecture is a giant setback. Like, if you're not okay with setback, then you're not okay with being an architect. I would say, you know, we lost so much. We lose so much. It's incredible in terms of competitions and jobs. And, you know, like, I think that this idea of setback is just it's a thing that you have to say, like, actually it's fuel for the fire. And so recognizing that, I think, is the most important thing to me. What other kind of setbacks have we had? So I thought that I could get away. I thought that I could get away with practicing architecture, but not having to get licensed in architecture. And my partners and employees have architecture licenses, but then the authorities in Canada really cracked down on me. And, you know, at first I kind of, you know, just sort of like lawyered up and was like, listen, I'm doing everything legally. I tell people I'm not an architect. I'm a designer. My partners are licensed. I have 2 degrees in architecture. I teach at architecture school at the University of Toronto. I'm not a charlatan. I'm not a fraudster. I just didn't want to get my license. It was kind of it was core to what it was core to this, you know what I mean? It was like critical to that, that I not be, you know, part of the system. And when I finally got the, you know, after years and years and years of, you know, fighting the fight, they basically said, listen, like, we're actually going to start fighting you now. We're actually going to take you to, we will sue you and we will defend the profession. And that was a huge setback because I had to go from being a child to being a grown up. And I had to sit down, study for a year. It was one of the most challenging years of my life. You know, you go back to school 10 years later, and it was one of the most grueling experiences of my life. The 300 or 400 pages of notes that I created over a year and learning how to meticulously go through the code, going through that, but then on the other side, passing those exams in one foul swoop was a big, big, huge personal victory. And I think, you know, my partner, John, was a big part of me being able to do that. And everybody at the studio supported me being able to do that. But, you know, at the same time, it's scary because the profession and the regulations within the profession are geared towards normalization and continuity, right? And so sometimes I fear that those apparatuses or structures affect creativity. So that was a really tough year, but I got through it. And to be honest with you, I think it's the best thing I ever did.
If you were to go back knowing what you know now and all the stuff you've went through, you know, back 22-year-old Alex, what advice would you have for yourself knowing what you know now?
Open your heart, fall in love.
Last question. What's next for Partisans?
I don't know. That's the best part. I have no idea. But I think that's important. That's how we want to live our lives.
Alex, thank you so much for taking the time to sit down and talk with me. I thought this was really awesome and I appreciate it. So thanks a lot, man.
Thank you for listening to an episode of Designed, an architecture podcast. We'd appreciate you taking a moment to subscribe to us, rate us, and leave us a comment. Have a wonderful day.